Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell. Joining me today is a recent guest, Julie O'Donohue. She's a Medill grad and recently came back from South Africa. The reason she's joining me as a guest today is our other guest, who was one of Julie's instructors at Medill, John Sullivan's Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He was part of the Philadelphia Inquirer's team that won the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for a series of articles in 2011 about underreported school violence in the Philly school system. Recently, John moved to Washington, D.C., where he was jointly hired by the Washington Post, American University, and the Investigative Reporting Workshop. Welcome, John. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
So jointly hired by these three different organizations, could you tell us what that means and what the significance of that is?
It means that nobody's happy. We have three bosses, right? No, what we tried to do here was try to develop a journalism program that would allow students to do high-level, high-quality investigative work in a working publication, The Post, and to also take a class at the same time at American University, get credit for this. And so we've developed this essentially a practicum. It's like an internship program where graduate students work on the investigative team at The Post several days a week, and they work with me on my stories or with any of the other investigative reporters on their stories, and they get credit for that.
Is there any particular sort of overall semester project that they're working on, an investigative piece, or is it just day in, day out, whatever comes up?
No. I mean, we try to focus on the process. And so for them, what they're getting is they're getting a chance to work in a 10-person investigative team where they get to watch all the other stories develop, talk to the reporters about how they're doing their stories, and then work on stories that we're working on. We don't guarantee them that the story will be completed by the time the semester's over, and we don't guarantee them that they'll get bylines, although we hope that they do and we want them to, and we want them to contribute significant reporting. But we try to teach them the process. And we try not to create some kind of artificial structure because we think it's more important for them to just learn how it's done and how it's done at a very high level. We want them to be professional. We want them to learn from the best.
So let's sort of set a baseline here. I mean, when people talk about journalists, you know, a journalist investigates a story, interviews sources, et cetera. What for you defines or makes a separate distinction for an investigative journalist?
Well, I mean, I don't know if there is a proper distinction. I mean, I think we say it because it's easier to let people know the scope of your work. But the reality is that many reporters do a lot of the things investigative reporters do every day. I think probably one of the keys is that we look for wrongdoing. We look for harm. We don't typically, we're analyzing a problem. We're trying to determine what is the true state of this agency or, and so we're usually trying to determine, is there something wrong here? And I think a lot of reporters do that, but I think a lot of reporters also do lots of other types of stories too. Investigative reporters focus mainly on those things.
Oh, is it so sort of the scope or more the subject that you're actually looking at? You're looking at maybe, I don't know, the government reporting or crime or...
I think it can be really more kind of the framework. So, you know, we want to try to find out the things about subjects that people don't want us to know. We want to try to... We're analyzing them in a framework of, is this system functioning the way that it was designed to function? Is it performing up to its own described values? Whatever. And I think we're trying to determine: is there anybody here in this system who is getting shortchanged, harmed? So most of the stuff I write about, I'm trying to determine: are people being harmed? That's mostly what I'm interested in.
So are you going to be looking at sort of, quote, local stories or national stories?
We can do anything. We can do national or local. I mean, my particular interest is in local stories because I've always been a metro reporter. I mean, I shouldn't say that. I've done national stories. I've done national investigative stories, and I've think I've done them at a high level, but my heart really lies with urban metropolitan reporting.
It was kind of interesting as we were sort of setting up the mics and everything, we got involved in this sort of conversation about immigration in the DC area and sort of the way that's covered or not covered or how it could be better covered. And I think I got kind of a peek into the way you think or see things is that, you know, obviously you commented that, you know, that's a really complex story and there are lots of different levels that you have to sort of address. And so you're not just necessarily covering one aspect of it. You're actually sort of thinking, I'll say globally, but, you know, what the impact of a system that's working or not working and how it affects people.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we try to do is we try to recognize that, that most problems are fairly complex and that it's easy to have a knee-jerk reaction and say, this is bad.
Right.
But we try to understand kind of why is it not working this way? Is this incompetence? Is it corruption? Or is it just basically good people working hard to try to figure something out that's really hard to figure out?
And how important is that element on the other side of that, which is that you're writing this to expose something to, you know, make things better? I mean, is that, you know?
Well, I mean, I think it's like it's an issue of fairness. I mean, I think that most of the time it's really how you write that story. Obviously, as investigative reporters, look for people doing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the time that's primarily what we're interested in. We're not really writing issues stories.
Mm-hmm.
But in the process of evaluating something, you really want to determine, is this basically kind of it's not that you wouldn't write this story, but you wouldn't spend as much time on it. You'd write it much sooner. You probably, it's more of a he said, she said.
Sure.
We look for stories that we can prove that something is the way that it is because of a series of circumstances. Our job is not to say, oh, there's a lot of smoke here. And if we can't, so our job is to say, there is smoke here, and it's coming from this fire right here, and this is how that fire got started.
So is the tendency with stories like that, then, that by their nature, they're going to be a little bit deeper, that they may require a little bit more reporting?
You mean where we're looking to make sure to prove that there's fire? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it can take a year, 2 years.
I feel like we're talking really in the abstract. Can you maybe
give us
some examples or talk about some of the stories that
you've
done?
Well, maybe the story that you worked on or the project you worked on at the Inquirer about the Philadelphia schools. Can you sort of describe that and what went into that?
So that project, like a lot of projects, grew out of a different project. So I had been writing about Child Protective Services in Philadelphia for many years. I did a big project with a guy named Ken Delanian, who now covers national security for the LA Times. We did a project about children getting beaten to death in Philadelphia after their families had come to the attention of Child Protective Services. And that prompted a very large overhaul of the system, the firing of two of the top officials, the criminal indictment of 18 people and the conviction of 18 people for the death of this one girl, Danielle Kelly. So it was, you know, they were convicted of fraud and all sorts of other things. They were supposed to be visiting this child and they weren't. These were contractors. And so I got a really good view into that system, and I realized that there were many systems that children in Philadelphia all the time were were basically in one of these three systems, and seldom did one system know about what the other system was doing. Then later on, about a year later, I spent a summer in the emergency room at the hospital, University of Pennsylvania. I was a medical writer at the time, and I was writing about how doctors repair gunshot wounds. And so I was seeing these kids come in. They were very young, and they were, you know, dying there in the ER after being shot. And I started talking to the people involved in these cases and came to understand that these kids often were suspended 30, 40, 50 times from school. They had multiple interventions. And so I started trying to figure out, how can I describe all the intervention that goes into turning around a child who's now 15, who's lying on this table, or who's just shot this kid?
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the only place where those records are available, which is when juveniles are charged as adults. They're called direct file cases. They're all over the country. Every jurisdiction has them. when the prosecutors want to charge a child as an adult, they file that case directly to adult court, and then a judge has to determine, is that child fit to be tried as an adult? Are they amenable to rehabilitation in the juvenile system? Should they be adjudicated delinquent instead and placed in some kind of facility? Or have they been through the system for so long and they've committed so many crimes, they really are deserving of being tried as an adult?
Mm-hmm.
So when you do those cases, I know this is a very long answer, but when you do those cases, all those records become public. School records, psychological evaluations, DHS history.
Things that would necessarily be...
even for a child?
Even for a child.
Wow.
Things that would be illegal to get in any other way. So the judge that runs that court is a guy named Ben Lerner. And Ben Lerner had been a kind of instrumental in the DHS series because he allowed us into the courtroom and allowed us a window into a lot of these DHS cases. And he did the same for me in this. You know, he said, this is you should come over here and look at this. It's really important when I asked him about it. So when I was in there doing that, I started seeing these pretty remarkable cases of kids who had been suspended many, many, many times. I went to Vernon Loeb, who was my editor at the time, and I said, I really want to do this story. And he said, great.
Who's now at the Washington Post.
He's now the Metro Editor. A couple weeks later, however, we had this incident in South Philly High where 30 students, Asian students, were beaten in this very large melee. And so we began writing about that. And when I began to see the district's response to that incident, where they essentially said, yes, we know it's a problem, we know violence is an issue, but we do not want young African-American boys to be arrested for assault in our schools because we're afraid that once they're in that system, they may never get out of it.
Hmm.
And that was a legitimate and real fear. And I thought, you know what? I think that's probably true.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if you're not going to do that, you must be doing something else. What are you doing?
Right.
And so I knew that from seeing these other stories that they weren't doing much. I mean, I knew that these kids were just suspending these kids over and over again.
Right.
They weren't really intervening. So I said to Vernon, and actually to Vernon's credit, you know, we should look at this. And Vernon said, yeah, we should look at it. And you should work with the Metro desk and the education reporters to do a deeper, more substantial story about this problem. So it was kind of where our interests really intersected. And we had done the story 2 years earlier, and that was a little bit of an issue. But Bill Marimo and I met for lunch, and I had just come off being a finalist for national reporting for a story on the EPA. And Bill said, you can do whatever you want. You've earned the right to do this story. And so Sue Snyder, a colleague of mine on the education desk who had covered the Philly schools for 10 years, set out on the story. We spent about a year on it together alone. We wrote the first five parts. Kristen Graham also helped on those first five parts. She was the current education reporter. And then she wrote part six, and Jeff Gamage, a really beautiful features writer, did this narrative story about what it's like to turn around a Philly school. That was part seven.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it all happened.
So how was that package sort of put together? Was it all just, you know, was it just text and photos, or did you...
Text, photos, video. We did a lot of our interviews on camera. We really tried to... I mean, I think the problem I had with the previous series was that I felt like it didn't really let people know what it was like to be a kid in mm-hmm. those schools. I felt like they let you know what it was like to be a teacher getting punched out by a student, but it wasn't what are the 19 kids in this class who really want an education doing when right. these two kids are fighting? And that's really what we wanted. Or what's it like to be the victim of violence as a student? How does it weigh on your ability to get an education? And that's, I think, the perspective that comes from reporting on that system for a long time. I mean, I knew I just didn't want to do it. These are all a bunch of city kids beating each other up, because
right.
that's not really the story.
Right.
That's not the truth of the matter.
It's real easy to simplify it down to that so that people right. can move on to the next story on the page, but you're really not telling the truth of the story, which has all these other nuances to it, that you as an investigative reporter, because you're in the trench for so long and we're able to pull all these different pieces together, able to present in a different way.
Yeah.
one of the things, one of the concerns that a lot of people talk about with the state of journalism right now is, you know, as newsrooms are cutting their staffs and they're moving their resources around, being able to do this type of investigative reporting on something, you know, how difficult is that becoming, do you think? Or is it getting better?
Well, like, for example, during the course of this project, Bill Marimo got fired, Vernon Loeb quit and came to the Washington Post. Mike Leary, who's the managing editor, had been bumped down to investigations editor. He became the editor on this project. Mm-hmm. The paper went bankrupt. It got sold and purchased, I think, twice during the course of this series. I tried to find another job, frankly. You know, it was just it was a really difficult time to do that. And the paper was losing massive amounts of money. It probably, I think at one point they said publicly that they were losing $17 million a year. Could have been even more. So I think that's a big challenge. The good news is, though, is that most papers recognize that investigative reporting is kind of the thing that they can offer that most other places can't. And so, for example, at the Post, the special investigative team, which is the one that I'm on that's run by Jeff Lean, now has 10 reporters on it. There's national investigative reporters. There's metro investigative reporters. There's investigative reporters all over that place. I think there's more than 20 investigative reporters at the Post. So I think papers are making an investment in investigative reporting. And I also think this whole rise of the nonprofit, you know, universities, nonprofits, and newspapers are working so well together, and I think I'm a prime example of that, mm-hmm. to kind of find creative ways to fund the work. So that's what I think is kind of exciting about this job, is that I get to kind of be one of the early shared reporters.
The pioneers in this.
John, can you talk a little bit about like your background and how you got interested in journalism when you were a young person?
Well, I came to reporting late. I mean, I think my first full-time job as a journalist was when I was 31. I'm right. 46 now. I don't look it. I know it's...
You're so just, boyish.
Exactly. Thank you. So I was not a great high school student. I was not going to go to college, so I worked in an upholstery shop for almost 5 years.
And really?
Yes.
Where?
In Highland Park, Illinois, for two brothers, great guys. And there was a lot of drinking in our upholstery shop. But so after about 5 years, and I began working at a gas station on the weekends. After about 5 years of that, I decided that this wasn't going to be a great life for me. One of the guys at the gas station had just fallen off a stool in the bar and cracked his head open. And I thought, well, that's probably where I'm headed if I don't change some things. So I went to community college, and I happened to get this great professor at Oakton Community College in Illinois named Dr. Margaret Lee, who taught at University of Chicago, and she taught literature. And so I took this honors class with her and really got interested in, you know, writing and how powerful it was, and philosophy and all these, you know, I really was awakened to this, this world. So then I went to college and studied philosophy and politics, and I had a minor in classical languages, and I was going to go into classical political thought, I thought, but my brother was a journalist, and I couldn't get a job. I got a job selling title insurance. So basically, I went from bank to bank talking to loan officers about buying title insurance, which is its own kind of hell. But
is your brother still a journalist?
He is still a journalist. Okay. His name is Drew Sullivan. He runs an NGO in Bosnia that investigates organized crime and corruption. So he was a reporter, and he was working at IRE, NICAR, as a graduate student at Missouri. And then he got a job at the AP in New York, special assignment team. And I went to this investigative reporters and editors conference that was held at my brother-in-law's brewery in Chicago. It was like a big party my brother was throwing. And I met these people, and I thought, God, these people are crazy. They're irreverent. They're so much fun. They're doing important work. What am I doing selling title insurance? So I called Laura Washington, who was the editor of the Chicago Reporter and the publisher actually at the time. And I said, I'll file your files. I'll sweep your floors. I'll do whatever it takes to learn how to do this. And she said, sure, come down. And that's how I started. So I spent a year at the Chicago Reporter. I broke a kind of
Can you explain what the Chicago Reporter is?
So the Chicago Reporter is a monthly investigative newspaper. It's actually a magazine. It was started in the 1970s. It focuses on the issues of race and poverty in Chicago. And actually, one of the former publishers just joined the Post before I did, Kimberly Kelly, pretty remarkable reporter and editor at the Chicago Reporter for 8 years. She was there. So it's got a great investigative tradition. And at the time, Tom Korfman, Laura Washington, and Jim Wisella, who's an instructor at Medill, ran it. And so I worked there for a year, broke a pretty big story about the state police spending a lot of money on a new computer system that didn't track hate crimes, which was required in the law. And I got on the Mara Tap show, which was a local NPR affiliate, and for an hour in the show. And I just thought, oh my God, you know, this is pretty incredible that you can write a story and that people would respond to it and that it would cause some change. And this is a great profession. So then I went to Missouri, worked for Irie Nightcar, and then wound up at the News and Observer in Raleigh. And my mentor there was Pat Stith, a legendary investigative reporter who taught me basically most of everything I know about investigative reporting.
From that sort of path and then to the Enquirer, how did you end up becoming an instructor at Northwestern?
So what happened was, after about 9 years at the Enquirer, a lot of the editors were telling me at the time, you know, that the prospects for the paper were not good and that I should probably try to move along while I could.
Back to selling title.
Yeah, back to selling title insurance. My wife was also a reporter at the Enquirer at the time. And so I was looking for something new. And, you know, the market was pretty tight at the time. I had applied for a Nieman Fellowship. I was a finalist. So I was interviewing for the Nieman, and I got a call from Rick Tulsky, who is kind of a longtime investigative reporter who won a Pulitzer at the Enquirer in the 80s. He's a kind of a tremendous character, very well known. And he was starting this thing at Medill, where he was going to try to do investigative reporting with about 10 students a quarter. Mm-hmm. And he was looking for somebody who was kind of had different strengths than he did. And I was referred by Bill Marimo. And actually, Bill didn't recommend me because Bill is he's a very ethical man. And he would not, since we both worked at the Enquirer, even though he had just been fired, he would not refer me to Rick because I think he felt like that would be disloyal to the Enquirer. But Rick called me anyways. Rick actually asked Bill, is there any young reporters there who know of young reporters who do investigative work? And Rick called me. And after talking to Rick for about a half an hour about the job, I said, it sounds like you're looking for someone like me. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, I was hoping you'd say that. So I went out there and we started Medill Watchdog. I mean, he'd already had it running for a little while there. But
so what type of things did Medill Watchdog work on?
So we did the first story we did, which was in the works when I arrived, was a story about how lawmakers and public officials in Illinois can moonlight as lobbyists. Mm-hmm. And although it's not something that was widely abused, there were individuals who did take advantage of that. And so we found, for example, a city official who was a paid lobbyist for a company while at the same time he was introducing ordinances that would grant contracts to that same company. Mm-hmm. And we found other lawmakers who had lobbied on behalf of agencies that they were being paid for at different levels. So in other words, they were paid to be a lobbyist in the city of Chicago for an association, and they were introducing and supporting bills in the state legislature where they were lawmakers that supported that same association. So that ran in the Chicago pages of the New York Times.
Wow. So how do you teach something like that? You get a new semester of students in, you know, what's your starting point? You're going to say, okay, we're going to cover something or other. Do they bring in ideas? Do you guys have a project you're working on?
Well, it depends. I mean, I think it's done a variety of different ways. I mean, I know instructors come in with ideas and say, we're going to do this, and then the students do all the work and all the writing. I know our model at Medill was Northwestern wanted Rick and I to write the stories. Mm-hmm. So they wanted kind of highly professional work done. They didn't want student-written projects, and that was their decision. So, and I think that can be a good model, too. But students don't tend to get bylines then, and the kind of acclaim of the work doesn't fall to the university as much as it does to their instructors. So the way that we did it there was that we came up with the ideas, and we basically tried to teach them how to undertake the process. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reality is, you probably, I think I'd be safe in saying that, like Jeff Lean would say, that it's very difficult to make an investigative reporter. They mm-hmm. they really are kind of come out that way, you know. And I think that's largely true. I mean, I do think that there are reporters who have this kind of incredible desire to get to the truth, no matter what the personal cost is, as far as time and effort and energy. Certainly, they're not crusaders, but they just have this, you know, unquenchable curiosity about what is really going on here. And they're very smart about, you know, how they see the world and these problems. I mean, they know kind of, they have this kind of instinct about how the world works and how people relate to each other. So, but I think you can take people, you can make people who are not born investigators excellent reporters, mm-hmm. and they will be excellent reporters. And the beats that they cover, you can teach them about records, you can teach them about kind of what's good practice for how often they check records, what records they check, how do you look at your beat, how do you mm-hmm. master your beat. And then for the investigators, they really do excel in these kinds of programs, and they basically, they just start running, and you guide them. You know, it's like a little kid. You really just try to not get in their way.
So do you say they come out that way? Do they, you know, when they start working into it, do they sort of begin to feel that in themselves?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, you can see it begins to really start to awaken this kind of side of them that they probably suspected they had but never really exercised. And once they begin to exercise that muscle, they just don't stop.
I mean, I went through the program, so I can talk a little yes. bit about
well.
It. I think, like, the value, at least, of Watchdog, I don't know much about what John's doing now, but is that it kind of, you get a little bit of guidance on what the best process is for looking for information that would lead to a good investigative story. That's what I gleaned from it, and I thought it was really valuable.
Yeah. So, and yeah. I think, like, the project Julie worked on, we did this, we were doing something for the Tribune where we were looking at certain types of facilities, and we were trying to determine, are these facilities good operators or not? And so we put together kind of a checklist of about 16 documents, and the students went out and gathered all this information. And then during the course of it, you know, we began to be able to determine how good are they at evaluating the information? How good are they at finding kind of what's below the surface? And Julie actually was on a very good team, her and a young lady named Alex Shostakovich, who now works at the Tribune as a reporter, were a team. And you could really see that they had some experience, but more importantly, that they really tried to understand kind of what's beneath the records. The records only show you, you know, kind of a little bit of what's
yeah.
there.
For me, it was valuable because I got to look at, first of all, you had someone there who kind of had more of an idea of what they were doing. But you could look at like a 990 or a police report, or I guess we went into PACER, some court documents, and you had someone there to tell you whether this is like usual, unusual. You know, some of this stuff is a little bit hard or difficult to figure out, I think, on your own. Or I would have found it hard to figure out on my own. And we went, John and Rick sent us around the state to look at documents in courthouses. So I saw a lot of Southern Illinois I wouldn't have otherwise seen.
Very flat.
Very flat.
Yeah. I'm from Indiana, so yeah, I know that's you know. Start in Ohio and just keep walking until you run into the Rockies. So, in my own personal experience as an editor, I agree with you. You know, I saw a lot of reporters, but I can think of two off the top of my head that there was something about them that, you know, they wouldn't necessarily go home at the end of the day. They had to go and do the extra work because they needed to solve this problem or they needed to tell this story.
Right.
So, again, it's, I don't know if it's a calling or whatever you want, however you want to put it, but it's just the way they come out and the way they view, you know, the types of stories that they're telling, that it's not just a matter of, you know, this is my job. This is, you know, I'm trying to do something here to make a difference and to change things.
And there are, I mean, just because you have that skill and ability doesn't mean you're going to be in my view, a great investigative reporter, because I think there are other things that go into it. And I think the best investigative reporters have a sense of kind of what's important. And they're not going to spend... I know reporters that have been obsessed with and gotten onto stories that they spent years on that in the end just weren't that important.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think having a sense of, you know, if you're going to expend this amount of energy, are you cognizant of what you're spending it on? Is the payoff going to be there?
Return on investment.
And so that's why, like, I think I like to look for harm, you know, because anytime I come to a new area, I try to figure out what is the most important story to the people living in this area. That, and you know, a lot of times that relates to, you know, are they losing something that they have? Are they being, you know, harmed in some way? I usually look at vulnerable populations because, frankly, they're the ones who need our voice more than anything.
There's somebody who tend not to have a representation in some way.
Right. And there's also a huge, I mean, it can be the general population when it's somebody who's a company or something that's putting out a product that they're aware can be harmful, but the regular guy in the street doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, there's a lot of varieties of that. It could be, you know, the denial of the right to a good government. I mean, so there's a lot of different ways to frame that up. And a lot of those things, you know, not every story you're going to do is going to be life and death. But that's just tends to be where I like to spend my time.
So one of the things that we sort of talk about on this podcast, you know, is digital journalism and how that sort of changed journalism in general. How has it changed? Has it helped investigative journalists in the way they tell the stories, but also the way they gather their information?
What do you mean by digital journalism?
Well, being able to tap into, you know, data.
Records,
large
and, yeah.
Records like that, being able to, you know, something you talked about before with your project in Philadelphia, being able to incorporate video and other aspects of it. So you're not just writing a text story, but you're actually able to bring in other ways to sort of fill in and tell the story and then present, for example, data that you've been able to bring into it.
Well, I think it's helped and hurt. I mean, so I started out as a data reporter. I mean, I was at NICAR and I did data analysis and basically took these large databases. And, you know, I think what you learn is that databases are a starting point. There can be like a kind of part of a notion that something is going on there. But they don't necessarily prove your story, and they don't necessarily describe what's going on in the street, because records can be they're complicated, and
mm-hmm.
and somebody checking the box is making a decision and you don't know how they're making that decision. But so I think that in one sense that records are great once you know that there's a story there and that you've gone out there and you've been able to figure out on the street that this is really something that's having a consequence. Then you can go back, and the records allow you to kind of prove it in a systemic way,
mm-hmm.
whereas you may, you know, just understand it anecdotally. For example, if you heard of something happening to somebody, you might not be able to, like, say it's a police shooting. You could go through the clips, and maybe you could round that up. You could try to FOIA from the local department all the police-involved shootings. But the FBI has a database, and they keep a database of every time somebody in a police force uses force or discharges their weapon in the line of duty. And so maybe that number is going to be a lot higher than you might have suspected.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it helps. It hurts in this sense. I think a lot of people and reporters feel like, and I think they're probably quickly disabused of this notion, but I think they feel like that the data is enough. That,
mm-hmm.
that once you find that golden database, you're going to be able to kind of...
Here it is. Here's everything.
Divine from all these records what is really going on. And most of the times, records don't really describe very accurately the true heart of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can only really be used in combination and should only be used in combination.
That doesn't take the place of reporting and
right.
fact-checking.
And a lot of times, you know, with fewer resources and fewer reporters, a lot of times big papers – who don't have the staff of a place like the Post, have to rely on one reporter covering a county who may spend most of their time looking at agendas or the things like that. And I can't tell you how many stories we've looked at over, I've looked at over my career, where the records just gave no indication at all of the problem, either because they were poorly kept or the agency that was keeping them didn't really want to draw attention to what was going on, or for a variety of factors. So, I mean, you got to get in there and talk to people, because they're the ones who, it saves you so much time when you're in there talking to people in an agency, because they're people and they're not a database. A database can't recognize when something outrageous happens.
Right.
And they're not talking about it around the water cooler, and they're not saying, remarking on it. They're not making that human observation that says there's something discordant about this. There's a difference between what is and what ought to be, you know, which is this kind of essential human trait that we all have that makes us laugh at things that surprise us and, you know, makes us say that's odd. And writers and comedians use it all the time to trick us.
Right.
And so we have this essential quality that a database doesn't have. You can't program risibility. And so that interaction with a human being making this observation is, it's the whole ball game.
And it helps you make those connections that to tell the bigger story.
Yeah.
Because the data is just going to just be what the data is.
Yeah, and they're feeling something, and what they're feeling is important to them, and you can tell that, and it makes you pay attention to it.
Right, and that's what, and just from a writing standpoint, that's what people are going to respond to. They're not going to respond to just numbers. They want to know what the emotional connection is.
I used to write the big mega turds, you know, I mean, the 4-part series that nobody read but some official somewhere buried in a basement, and I thought I was doing great work, but I realized I had this editor at the Inquirer and also at the News and Observer, Trish Wilson, who really kind of emphasized for me, tell me what this means to people. I want people. I want to meet them. I want to know them. I want to understand them. I want to know what they're wearing. That really kind of awakened me to that. And I'm not going to be a writer like Kate Boo is, and if you read her 1999 investigation into the mentally disabled in D.C., it's one of the most beautifully written, powerful investigations that's ever been done.
Her book about the slum in India,
yeah,
like makes you want to cry. Yeah,
yeah, that's the kind of human connection and reporting that is a. I mean, it's rare to have both those qualities, I think, and I still make all my students, if they will, read that series. I've given out to, I don't know, 50 students, because I just think it's such an important part of our job is to kind of capture the humanity of people and really help people understand what they're feeling and facing, that this is a problem that's not just an abstract.
Yeah, and that's part of your formula. You have to move people.
Yeah,
I mean, you're doing all this reporting to invoke change, and you're not. You know, that's the point where you need to make your case. This is your the prosecutor making his case to the jury. Then you have to, you know, motivate those, convince those people that this is a bad thing. This is something that needs to change, and this is why it's important. And you know, get inside their head and make them feel, or in their heart, and make them feel that, okay, yeah, I see why this is important. I see why I need to write my congressman. I see now to get involved with my school system or whatever.
And by the way, this is where digital journalism has really helped, because we can put together, we can put together a web presentation that will allow us to show a video of we had this remarkable video of a little girl reading a poem about how she felt after somebody in her class reached under her shirt and grabbed her breasts, and she wrote this poem. It was just watching this 11 or 10-year-old girl read this poem with the little picture she drew of herself crying and realizing that as a reporter sometimes, you know, we were uncovering really shocking examples of violence in the schools, some of which we didn't report because it happened off, you know, on the way. It wasn't really clear that the school could have prevented it, but just really, really, really kind of heart-wrenching, horrible stuff. And so you might come across this and say, you know what, it's not as violent or as serious as some of these other incidents, but that's just not true to this 10-year-old girl. And that's what makes people understand it. and makes it impossible for them to dismiss. And that's why that we were so adamant, I think, about getting people to understand these children, because I think there could be a tendency to read the series and say, well, that's an urban problem. It's a city school, right. and this is a problem that's their problem. But I think when you introduce people to these children and let them see kind of what they're going through and what they really want, and it's clear to you as a reader that they want what you want, a good education, a way out, a way up, it just makes it so much more powerful.
Once you become empathetic and you can begin to see the human effect of something.
Yeah, and I think that's why that story did well.
John, do you think when people report on kids or issues like that, that the tendency is to try to write it as if you're the adult, like the adult perspective, like you were saying in that series, when the first time they did the series on school violence, that you felt like maybe the voice was like what it's like to be a teacher in the classroom?
Yeah, so that story was about kind of a teacher who'd been punched during a break and fell down and broke his neck. And so that story was really about kind of this kid had a history of violence, and that story was kind of like there are really violent kids in school and the school district doesn't do a lot to get them out, and they end up perpetrating these crimes. And I think that's part of the story, but I think if you notice, if you read the series that we did not talk about discipline at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's never mentioned. I mean, maybe it's mentioned once in that series. But I said early on, this is not a story about discipline, because this is not a story about, part of the intervention can be discipline. Part of the intervention can be removal. But I think most schools recognize that, a lot of these kids really need a different kind of help. And if they can get them to that kind of help, and that could mean removing them, putting them in a special school or whatever it is, you're not going to have this problem. But if you leave a kid in school, even though they're punishing them, they suspend these kids 50 times. Well, where do they end up? They end up at home, on the street, hanging out, getting shot, shooting their friend. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's basically just pushing the problem off. So we really just felt like this is not something, we really would much rather tell what it's like to be a student in these schools and to really look at what is their interventional model, what is the thing that's really proven probably to have an effect on a school's climate, not just how many kids do they send home when they're acting bad.
Is it enough to just investigate and sort of shine light on this and humanize it, or is part of the role of investigative journalists also to offer solutions or to show where there's some sort of success in dealing with this?
I'm kind of mixed on this. I mean, I feel like that, we do kind of become experts in a way, but we're really more experts at describing the problem. And I think it's like I've always felt a little presumptuous and trying to offer a solution. And part of the reason, I think it's smart, and it's a good idea to say other places have looked at this problem and they found ways that they say work. But I think we have to recognize as reporters that we're not public policy experts, and that, a lot of times circumstances are different for different schools. Maybe you don't have the same quality of instruction, and therefore it's more difficult to implement program. Maybe you have a higher turnover. Maybe you have this, maybe you have that. So I think we try to say that there are other proven methods. I think where we what we pointed out to the district, and I think where we were on safe ground, is saying the district has never really given anything, has never consistently implemented a plan to deal with this problem.
Mm-hmm.
They've implemented a plan for a year and gone back to something else. I mean, they've never really followed through on anything they said they were going to do. And I think you're always kind of safe when you hold an institution to its own commitments.
Sure. No, not so much offering a solution, but just saying, look, they've done nothing. Doing something would be a good thing.
Yeah, anything.
Anything. But this is what you get when you do nothing.
Right. And so what does this say about their commitment to solving the problem? So I think a lot of times in investigative series, like for the DHS series, I mean, we didn't really offer any solution about Child Protective Services because we recognized that it is a really complex and difficult problem. And we didn't know how to solve it, really. I mean, you could say they need lower caseloads. You could say they ought to do this, they ought to do that. But think about it. You're a reporter. They've been doing this for 50 years. Sure. Some of these people have been caseworkers for 25 years. And you're going to come in there and you're going to say, you should do it like Florida's doing it. Well, who knows if that's going to work?
Right.
And don't you think they've have thought of that?
Right.
But the question, so what you do is you say, you try to determine what has their commitment been to solving the problem. Have they denied it? Have they addressed it head on? What have they, and failed because of, you know, whatever, incompetence, corruption, lack of follow-through, whatever? That's really what you're looking at. I don't think it's fair to say, well, they spent 3 years trying this program, and it's got mixed results. I mean, that might be a story that somebody would write, but I'm not necessarily interested in that. I mean, I think that's more of a public policy story.
Okay, well, let's sort of wrap this up. And one of the things we try to do with the podcast is to look to the future, and not necessarily expecting you to look into a crystal ball and say this is what journalism is going to be. But what are your hopes or your thoughts about, you know, the direction that investigative journalism is heading? Do you feel good about it? Do you think that there, you know, certainly there are going to be challenges ahead, but, you know, are you pretty positive about the way things are going, or you have mixed feelings?
Well, I mean, I think that I feel positive that there seems to be, that there is among many newspapers and newspaper editors a commitment to continue to try to do the work at the highest level and a desire to do it. And I think that I've been impressed with the fact that places, especially like the Times and the Post, are embracing new kind of ideas and models. And, you know, many papers across the country have created these partnerships. And so I think you're seeing, you know, two really positive things, a way to train students how to do the work at a very high level, which, you know, frankly, students are getting opportunities that we never got when mm-hmm. we were young reporters. I mean, if I came into a paper, I would never get to intern. To intern on the Post I team is a pretty rare thing. The Inquirer probably wouldn't allow it. So it's kind of opening up a world to students that they may not have gotten a chance to participate in before. It's going to make them better reporters, at least. And some of them it's going to make turn into investigative reporters, and they're going to be very successful. And I think you're seeing that papers are willing to hire very young reporters in their 20s who can do the work. They're not so interested in anymore. You have to go through this kind of long right. process of 4 years in the suburbs. I mean, I think that's a good process, but I also think that what you end up doing is discouraging really talented people who don't necessarily need that. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think they're moving people up quicker who have the skills and abilities. I think they're looking to new kind of creative partnerships to help fund and help produce great investigative work. You know, at the same time, I think that we're facing some headwinds. One of them is the beat structure at papers has to be strong in order to get great investigative, you know, stories. You can't just go in as an investigative reporter and just start looking at every record, and we do it. And we read the paper and we do all these things, but the best stories really do bubble up from the beats mm-hmm. and you need reporters working those beats to find those stories. So I think we have some work to do there, but I think that's kind of a problem with the economics of the newspaper business right now, and I think that'll change. Paywalls seem to be working in a lot of places, and I think places like the Post and the Times that they'll continue to work. So I think you're going to see, you know, the continuation of pretty high-level work.
Now, yes,
I was going to add one thing. You know, the other thing is there are these kind of, like at American, the Investigative Reporting Workshop, which Chuck Lewis started after starting Center for Public Integrity.
Sure.
You know, there are these operations that basically seek to try to create these, you know, synergies among working reporters and students and publications. And I think they're getting more successful. I think ProPublica has moved kind of more to that model a little bit. The partnerships are hugely important. And I think that, you know, that can't be underestimated. Those kind of workshops and those spaces to do this kind of work are also really important. And they're continuing to be funded, and they're continuing to produce good work. So I think that's also a very positive,
positive thing. And I know that when people are looking for looking at sort of the future of journalism and you know, how can journalism sort of make itself viable? I certainly, investigative journalism, something that we've done really well for a very long time, I think is something that can contribute to that, and hopefully that we can continue to do and help journalism to grow.
Yeah, I get the good fortune of getting to see all three of these things. I mean, I'm a part of each one of these entities, part of a university, part of a workshop, and part of the Post, and I see benefits from all of them, and it's just amazing how quickly students can work into an operation like the Post and make important contributions. I mean, I just think it's pretty remarkable.
And the benefit is not just the Post, but it's actually the public who benefits from those stories.
Yeah, and the great thing about teaching is that you see students like Julia and you like to be called Julie, right?
Julie.
You see students like Jules. Julie and others who are like very promising, and you think to yourself, okay, well, there is a future here for this, and these kids are willing to do it, and they're willing to work hard at it. So,
excellent. Well, thanks again for coming in. Now, where can people check out your stories at the Post?
Are you on Twitter?
Are you on Post yet?
So I work at the Post full time, practically. I mean, I'm there 4 days a week. When I'm 1 day a week at American and the workshop, but usually I'm working on stories that I'm working on at the Post, and in about a year they might be able to see something. So you know, this, I'm working on a story now, but it's probably several months away from even a memo, and so we'll see how long it takes to do.
We'll keep an eye on it, and whenever it gets published, we'll make sure that we link to it on the website. But thanks again for coming in, John. This is really great.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of the media. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about us at itsalljournalism.com. We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com. Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @alljournalism.